Welcome to NACE Clinical Highlights. I'm Dr. Greg Sherman, Chief Medical Officer for NACE. Joining me today for a discussion on the use of GLP-1 receptor agonists for type 2 diabetes mellitus is Dr. James Gavin. Jim is the Chief Medical Officer of Healing Our Village Incorporated and Clinical Professor of Medicine at the Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia, and he's also a past president of the American Diabetes Association. I'm really excited to spend a few minutes with him today to hear his insights on the GLP-1RA class of therapeutics and how we as clinicians can do a better job of managing our patients with diabetes and specifically their related cardiometabolic risk factors. So welcome, Jim.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's a pleasure to join you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really glad that you could be here with me as well today. Jim, as you know, as well as anybody else, GLP-1s as a class of medications is recommended to improve glycemic control for patients with diabetes. But there is really a substantial body of evidence and even new guidelines in 2021 from the American Diabetes Association that really underscore that GLP-1RAs have non-glycemic as well as these glycemic benefits for our patients with type 2 diabetes and their various comorbid risk factors. So I was hoping to start our discussion today just to sort of briefly remind our colleagues that are listening about the underlying pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes and where the incretin effects of GLP-1RAs become an issue.
So first, it's important to remind people that type 2 diabetes is a complex pathophysiological condition. Everybody is aware of what we've been taught about the ominous octet, which is the array of defects that are involved. Well, there's also now the egregious 11. The bottom line is that many organ systems contribute to the pathogenesis and pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes. The GLP-1s are pleiotropic. They address multiple organ system defects, which is what makes them so attractive. For example, they have central effect. They suppress appetite. They promote early satiety. That means that people reduce their food intake. That helps with weight loss. When you lose weight, you improve insulin sensitivity. The core impact on the pancreas, extremely important on the beta cells. It promotes and facilitates a glucose-dependent release of insulin. And the alpha cell promotes a glucose-dependent reduction in glucagon. All of these things help to improve glucose uptake, reduce glucose production. And there are multiple other effects, Greg, in the gut. There are neurally mediated reductions in gastric motility reduction so that you don't get quite as rapid uptake of food that you eat. It reduces fat in the liver, helps with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. In the heart, it improves on an array of things. In the kidney, even, it improves natriuresis, may decrease angiotensin II. It's renal protective. So there are many organ system defects that are addressed by GLP-1s, all of which are beneficial in the complex pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes.
Jim, there's a lot of great information that you shared with us about this class of medications, but the one thing that I think I didn't hear quite yet is where we're at in terms of progression of kidney disease and this class of drugs' impact on it.
Yes. Well, the major impact of these agents is clearly on their reduction of CV risk. We see that liraglutide, semaglutide, and dulaglutide showed statistically significant reductions in MACE. Exenatide extended release was almost statistically significant. Lixi and oral semaglutide were safe, with the oral semaglutide showing fewer events, but it was not powered for superiority. With respect to the effects on kidney disease, the GLP-1s reduced composite outcomes of progression of diabetic kidney disease. And that means time to doubling of serum creatinine, reduction of EGFR by 40% or more, a progression to end-stage renal disease or dialysis, renal death, or development of macroalbuminuria. These are all important renal outcomes. liraglutide, dulaglutide, and semaglutide all showed statistically significant effects on renal outcomes. Lixi and exenatide were neutral. So the bottom line overall is that the GLP-1s are renal protective, and that confers a distinct benefit to the use of these cardioprotective GLP-1s, since they can be used in a broad spectrum of renal impairments, and that's extremely important in the type 2 diabetes population.
Thanks for that clarification, Jim. I want to let our listeners know that you can access an enduring CME activity on GLP-1 RAs for type 2 diabetes at our website, naceonline.com, and you can learn more about what Jim and I are discussing today. You can access this and many other programs we have developed on other topics. You can also register for one or more of the many live conferences we produce every year. If you're on Facebook, please like us, and we will be able to share more educational content and information with you. So, Jim, we just spent a bunch of time discussing some of the evolving data on GLP-1 RA therapy, but clearly this data has had an impact on treatment recommendations. I'd like to spend a little time discussing the new 2021 ADA guidelines and where the GLP-1 RA class of medications fits for our patients with a constellation of cardiometabolic risk factors, including atherosclerotic coronary artery disease and chronic kidney disease. What should our colleagues be doing differently now?
Well, one of the things we see, Greg, in the way the guidelines have emerged is that providers are now being encouraged to be a great deal more vigilant in the way they assess their patients in order to optimize the individualization of treatment. The array of new agents that we have, the data that's been generated that we just summarized on cardiovascular outcomes, the renal protection, the cardioprotection, all of these findings have now evolved to make sure that first clinicians screen their patients for the presence of ASCVD, independent of whatever their baseline A1C might be. Why? In order to make an appropriate choice about how to select agents that are going to be best suited to prevent progression of or recurrence of underlying atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. Now, there's some implications, because what the guidelines don't do and can't do is to provide the kinds of detailed directions that clinicians will have to invoke in order to make choice among their patients. For example, the clinician has to make the determination. If you don't have obvious data like presence of diagnosed coronary artery disease or the presence of a history of myocardial infarction, evidence of peripheral artery disease, you have to now be more vigilant. You have to make sure that you're doing pulses. You may have to take history so that you know whether or not you need to do ankle brachial index measurements. You may even need to definitively measure things like BNP in order to see whether or not there's underlying heart failure. In other words, clinicians have the responsibility of doing a careful assessment to know what is the vascular status of patients, because what the guidelines say, if ASCVD is present, now what you need to do is to select a GLP-1 receptor agonist with proven benefit for reduction of CV risk. The alternative, of course, is that you can use an SGLT2 inhibitor, but they're not the same. If, for example, persons have congestive heart failure, the SGLT2 inhibitors would be the preferred therapy because the data are more powerful there. But if you have other problems, if you have underlying kidney disease, and remember, that's a very common problem in people with diabetes, you may have limitations on your use of the SGLT2 inhibitors, so the GLP-1 receptor agonists become the preferred therapy. And when there's urgency for weight reduction, the GLP-1s have shown the greatest benefit in terms of weight loss. So we are still in the quest of determining who is the optimal patient for which therapy and even for which agent within a class of agents. But there are some details that we really have to be attentive to that begin with the level of A1C. You get more A1C lowering with the GLP-1s. The level of weight, you get more weight lowering. The presence of ASCVD, the level of kidney function, those kinds of details now are mandatory for providers in order to make optimal use of the very powerful therapies, including the GLP-1 receptor agonists that are now available to us.
Jim, I think that was perfect because you really set up the next thought that I think we should address, and that's really the role of the patient's perspective. You know, we do a lot of talk about shared decision making, and with so many therapeutic options available and so many pieces to this puzzle, I wonder how you're negotiating that. You know, now you have oral, you have injectable, you have combination therapies, even within one class of drugs. How do you fit that all in with the patient to come to the right decision? And when do you involve other providers of different specialties in your decision-making process?
Yeah, and this is really an evolving kind of paradigm, Greg, because of the new data that we have been made aware of. We really have to try to make sure that we know the patient well enough so that, one, we know what their level of risk is, because you have to discuss that very openly with the patient, that you have this underlying set of conditions, you are at this level of risk, and that means the full array, presence of established ASCVD, the presence of risk factors for ASCVD, so that you can lay out for the patient why it is that we want to make certain therapeutic recommendations and even share with them comparative data. They have a lot of little teaching aids for patients that will show you now comparative data on not only the amount of A1C reduction that you get with one agent versus another, but the amount of reduction of things like adverse cardiovascular event, the amount of reduction that you get in certain kidney outcomes. Patients can understand these kinds of things because you want to talk to them to get to a point where you ask the question, what might work best for you? Certain patients' lifestyles are such that they can deal with and they might want a once-a-day approach to a therapy, a once-daily approach. Others may really require and need a once-weekly approach. We now have an option for oral therapies with the GLP-1 receptor agonist. That's something that you need to talk through with the patient with respect to whether or not that aligns with their preferences and their lifestyles. Now, what we know is this. Coordination of care is really important. I've been in lots of settings, advisory groups, continuing education programs, where I've shared the stage with cardiologists and nephrologists, because now the nature of these agents that we're using actually means that we approach the cardiometabolic and the cardiorenal parameters of this disease jointly. The cardiologists have got to be comfortable with certain diabetes drugs. The nephrologists have got to be comfortable, and then vice versa. Coordination of care is very easily done within a health system where you know the other providers, you have access to the same electronic health records, but you might need to do it across systems where you don't have certain specialties represented. So you need to know, when is it time for referral? You need to know the contact information for the other members of the team that are going to be involved in the patient's care. Are you getting feedback from patients that you have sent to referrals? Not only information from the providers, the specialists that you might be referring to, but what about the patient's experience? Those are important items of information that you need to gather. And then don't forget about the pharmacists. They are very important members of this team, and we just have to make sure that the coordination is quarterbacked by a coach. I call that the person who is the primary provider, working with the major player, who is the patient, to make sure that all of the appropriate representatives on the team are there and doing what they're supposed to do, but doing it in a way that clearly articulates to the patient, why are we doing this? And is this the best fit for you? It's a lot to be done, but I think that's the evolution that we've come to for optimizing outcomes.
I think you said that so well, and it's something that we all need to always remember, that if the patient does not really understand the decision-making process, and we don't really understand the barriers and challenges that they face in managing their health, we're not going to achieve success. So it's really important that we're communicating, and I think you did a wonderful job of summarizing that for us. Jim, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me and share your expertise on GLP-1 RAs and how we can use them to do a better job of caring for our patients that have diabetes and at risk for other cardiometabolic risk factors. I think you provided some great information to our colleagues today.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation.
If you're interested in learning more about GLP-1 RAs and type 2 diabetes, go to our website at naceonline.com and register for our enduring activities on type 2 diabetes or any other program we've developed. Please like us on Facebook at NACME to be part of our online social media community and get access to other content and programs that we share. As for other upcoming podcasts in the future.